That assembly is called by the Parliament. It's called not by the church. It's called by the Parliament, which is an important point. It's a body of divines, which is to say ministers and laymen, ruling elders in the church, to advise the English Parliament as to how the church should be reformed.
Welcome back to Roundtable, a podcast produced by Mid-America Reformed Seminary. This is episode 56, and I'm Jared Luchibor. Thank you for joining us. You know, much of the theology of the Reformation has been documented for us, as we've seen in the past few weeks here on the podcast with the three forms of unity, the Belgic Confession of Faith, the Heidelberg Catechism, and the Canons of Dort, documents written in continental Europe. We're going to move away from the continent now and into English territory to Westminster Abbey, where we find the creation of the Westminster Standards in Presbyterian circles. So on the podcast today is Dr. Alan Strange and Dr. Marcus Minninger to talk a little bit about the background of one of these documents, the Westminster Confession of Faith.
Well, Jared, and all our regular podcast listeners and those who may be joining us afresh, we trust that you've been able to listen to the recent podcasts on the three forms of unity as you were introduced to those wonderful documents from the 16th century, the Heidelberg Catechism, the Belgic Confession of Faith, and then what was done to ensure that they were followed at the Synod of Dort later in 16, 18, and 19. Now we come to the Westminster Assembly of Divines, which produces for the context of Britain, England, and Scotland, the works that will be foundational to Presbyterianism as over against the continental reform. And so these are in, as you know, chronologically, as I just mentioned, these are the finishing, you might say, by way of symbolics or confessional documents of what had begun, right, back in the Reformation. Now we're in the 17th century. We're not in the junior varsity sort of situation anymore, but we're playing varsity. That's just a little fun thing that we do see here sometimes. But we're at the Westminster Assembly. Well, maybe we would begin with just a bit of the background. And the question is, how far back do we go? My wife always accuses me of always going back to the garden. I'm not going to do that this time. But I will say the English Reformation, I think many of you would be familiar with this, has a bit of a different origin than the reformations that occurred on the continent. The English Reformation didn't begin in exactly, you might say, a blaze of religious and spiritual glory. It began with Henry VIII, who wanted to divorce his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, and marry his second wife, Anne Boleyn. And in order to accomplish this, he found it necessary, ultimately because of what the Pope in Rome said, to separate from the Roman Church. But don't worry, this, of course, isn't the end of it. He had a son who did better than this, Edward VI, though his daughter, Mary Tudor, tried to take England back to the Roman Church. That didn't work out too well. But Elizabeth came along, and what you have in the English situation, as may be evident from what I'm saying, is the church is very dependent upon the monarch, which is to say the state in England is very clearly over the church. This is something that's commonly referred to as Erastianism, the state being over the church. And all of this amounted to something very concerning for a lot of people who came to be called Puritans. You had rise up during the time, particularly of Elizabeth, who was on the English throne from 1558 to 1603. You had rise up as she was a Tudor queen, you had Tudor Puritanism rise up. And I think many of you would be familiar with some of the figures there. But within that, Presbyterianism, as over against what the Church of England under from Henry all the way through Elizabeth had been, which was an Episcopal church. Episcopacy, of course, means that you have the rule of bishops. You have the rule of people at the level of the diocese. And at the parish level, you have ministers. Presbyterianism, however, is a system in which all ministers are understood to hold the same office. You don't have ministers that rank over the others. They all hold the same office, and they serve together with elders in what in the Scottish situation you would call the Scottish Kirk, which would be like, from the Continental Reformation, the consistory. But this together would form, you would have local churches, you would have presbyteries made up of a number of local churches in a region. You would have synods generally above that, and then the General Assembly, which would be the body for the whole church. So this is where things move in the English situation and setting. And James I comes to the throne in 1603. Elizabeth, as you may recall, the Virgin Queen, had no offspring. So it moved from the Tudor line to one of the parallel lines, one of the other lines, the Stuart line, her nephew. And he comes to the throne. Of course, the King James Bible, 1611, is something everybody knows about. That's something that was authorized by him at the Hampton Court Conference in 1604. So the Puritans are having actually quite a lot of say in this respect. James doesn't care for Puritanism, but he is something of a Calvinist. That's a huge discussion in itself. But his son, Charles I, who comes to the throne in 1625, does not have his father's interest too much in theology. He leans towards Roman Catholicism. He's not doesn't care for the Puritans, and he has an archbishop that he puts as the head of the church, the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud, particularly in the 1630s, and they began to impose very heavily on the church a liturgy and a theology that's Arminian. I don't think we'll need to spend a lot of time talking about that because the men who talked about those continental confessions talked about Arminianism. But Charles was imposing that. He was imposing a very strict episcopacy, and he was requiring that the prayer book, which had been adopted with the 39 articles back in 1571 in Elizabeth's reign, that that be exclusively what you use. So when a minister stood up in the pulpit, he should not pray extemporaneously. He should pray only from the prayer book. Previous to that, there had been some allowances for extemporaneous praying, but Charles would have none of that. And he particularly didn't like these Puritans. And there's a lot of details we could get into here, but we won't today. Just to say this, Charles, who actually sought to rule from 1629 to 1640 without calling Parliament into session, a policy he called thorough, he tried to do everything without Parliament. He was getting aid from the French, which that was not something people were happy about when they learned it, but he sought to rule without Parliament, and Parliament came into session into 1640, and immediately there was conflict with the king. He also had conflict with the Scots. So between the Scots and his own English Parliament, Charles came into a civil war developed between the English Parliament and the Scots and King Charles. And of course, Charles is Scottish, as you may recall. James is from the Scottish line. He was James the Sixth of Scotland. And now you have Charles the First of England, who is also the Scottish king. This is the background, really, for the calling of the Westminster Assembly. Because what you've had up to this point, you have had in the church situation, you have had 1560, you had the Scots Confession back in Scotland. In 1571, you had in England the 39 Articles. You've had in 1615 the Irish Articles. All of these three particularly, form the background for the calling of the Westminster Assembly of Divines. And that assembly is called by the Parliament. It's called not by the church, it's called by the Parliament, which is an important point. It's a body of divines, which is to say ministers and laymen, ruling elders in the church, to advise the English Parliament as to how the church should be reformed. And so this rather remarkable body was called together. The king said, you should not meet. He forbade them from meeting, but they did begin meeting. Nonetheless, the ordinance was passed on 12 June 1643, calling them to meet and to do three things, three aims the Westminster Assembly had. The reform of liturgy, discipline, and government in the Church of England, on the one hand. And then secondly, closer ties with the churches of Scotland and the continent. And then thirdly, the revision of the 39 Articles. So I mentioned the Scots Confession, the 39 Articles, and the Irish Articles. It's the 39 Articles that are the official, that's the official doctrinal statement of the Church of England. And at this point, when they begin meeting on July 1, 1643, that's when they begin. They meet from July 1, 1643 to 22 February 1649. For 1,163 sessions. They meet in the morning for plenary debate and in the afternoon in one of the three committees. But they meet over the course of the better part of 6 years. And all this work is done here, which is different, of course, than what you heard from the gentlemen who were talking about the three forms of unity in the previous podcast, because those three forms were over the course of some time. This is all done as part of one grand body. And so these meetings go forward, but what they begin to do is to revise the 39 Articles. They're not drafting a confession of faith. They're not doing any of that. That's not what they're originally called to do. And Article 11 on justification receives a lot of attention. If you're really interested in that sort of thing, that's talked about in some detail in a book I've written recently, which I think we've talked about at some point on something we've done here. But it's a book on the imputation of the act of obedience of Christ in the Westminster Standards. And it's a very important discussion. It's a very important article. But what happens is the Scots, I told you the Scots were also not happy with Charles I. They wanted Presbyterianism. They did not want Erastianism. They rejected it. They did not think the king should be over the church. They rejected episcopacy. As I say, they wanted to be Presbyterian. And they rejected Arminianism. So the three things that Charles was really pushing, they rejected. And they came into an agreement in October 1643. So now remember, July 1, 1643, they began working on the 39 Articles. And then in October, the English brethren and the Scots come together in the Solemn League and Covenant, and they form a new alliance, basically. And so you have the men from Scotland who never serve as voting members. We're talking people like Rutherford and Gillespie and Bailey. These and Henderson, those are some of the main members. They never serve as voting members. They're advisory delegates, but they have influence out of all proportion to that number. And so when the English and the Scots begin officially working together in October 1643, the assembly changes from looking at the 39 Articles. They say, oh no, we're going to need an entirely new confession of faith. But before they do that, they begin working on a directory for public worship, a directory for church government. They begin to working on these sorts of things. They do produce a Psalter, and there's some other things they produce. So there are these various products of the assembly. And I mentioned also, and I think it's really important to say here, in terms of tying this all in with Dort, there's some expression given in the preface to the Westminster Confession, to the work of the assembly as a whole, that talks about the assembly or the synod, which had been held in Dort 1618 and 19, and recognizes and regards that as, you could say, paradigmatic for how a church assembly should be and operate. They think the international flavor and the upholding of a vigorous Calvinism is a model for how an assembly should work. And they very much, in those three reasons that I gave you a bit ago, they very much want to model what they're doing now in the Church of England and the Church of Scotland, and they want to look more like the continental churches. So I say that to say, a lot of times we tend to understand and emphasize the differences between the continental churches and the Scottish churches, the Scottish-English churches. But at Westminster, they were very self-consciously wanting to be ecumenical in a proper sense, Catholic with a little C, among the Reformed churches. They thought it was very important that Reformed churches, whether in Britain or on the continent, have a good expression of doctrine that was in unity with each other. And so this becomes a very important matter.
So you're saying that the varsity team wanted to have good relationships with the junior varsity team. Is that, did I take that? Earlier you were pointing out a few differences, but now we just want to make sure and tie that all together.
Right. Yes. Well, I'm sure I'll pay for that many times over. but we like to tease around here, but we actually think as an institution who seeks to embody the best of these traditions, in all seriousness, there's enormous mutual respect. And I think that, many people would know that, you can think of the old Westminster, even at Princeton, Voss was there, right? And when Westminster was started in Philadelphia, it is the case that they very self-consciously drew from both the Scottish American Presbyterian tradition and the continental, particularly Dutch tradition, not only in terms of who they had on the faculty, but in terms of who they assigned to be read in the classroom. And of course, Dr. Van Til would say that one of his chief influences, certainly in terms of Bible interpretation and theology, would have been Gerhardus Voss. And so just to say this, to kind of tie it in with our institution, I mean, that is something I think that we strive here to do, to reflect that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, if you keep reading, not just with regard to confessional documents, where obviously the Westminster documents come chronologically later than the three forms, and so they have some developments in them, you know, and you can compare and contrast those just because they come later. But if you keep reading in the general history of Reformed thought, so many of the giants that we most directly stand stand upon their shoulders here, certainly in my discipline, but in a lot of disciplines, are our Dutch brothers, you know, that we, Bob Inck and Voss and Ritterbos and others, Kuyper, and as well, of course, Hodge and Warfield and those who came in the other stream of Reformed tradition. But it is very truly important to us to seek to appropriate the best of both of those streams. And you're saying, Dr. Strange, that the Westminster documents themselves, the Westminster Assembly itself, was already of that same mindset to seek to be cordially related to and utilizing, depending upon, in conversation with all the best that was going on in the continent.
Well, and explicitly so, because, I mean, I've been in contexts and situations where in our times, voices have been raised that really have contrasted them or painted them as in conflict. They certainly did not see, they didn't intend it, and they didn't see it. They did not see it that way.
Well, I hope that gave you a little flavor of the Westminster Confession of Faith. Next week, we'll get to enjoy some of the meatier portions of this document as Dr. Strange and Dr. Mininger reflect on the content of the Westminster Confession of Faith. I hope you'll join us then. For more podcast episodes, you can find us on our website at midamerica.edu, YouTube, and wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Be sure to search Mid-America Reformed Seminary's Roundtable. I'm Jared Luchador. Till next time.